From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration is now barring all travel by Congress on government aircraft during the shutdown unless there is White House approval. That's according to a memo today. The White House already blocked House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from using a military plane for a trip to Afghanistan after she suggested postponing the State of the Union address. We are now on day 28 of the government shutdown, and joining us now is Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois. Welcome back.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
And what do you think is the way out of this shutdown at this point?
Well, I think that the Senate really holds the key. Just a couple of days ago, I saw quite a few of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle working together to perhaps sign a letter to the president asking for an end to the shutdown. And if we can get 20 to 25 of them to sign the letter, that'll signal enough votes for an override and enough votes to call for a reopening of government, and hopefully that will allow Leader McConnell to allow us to vote on the House bill that would reopen government that Speaker Pelosi sent over.
You think that the Republican senators would do an override over President Trump's veto and actually reopen the government even against his wishes?
Oh, I would never speculate that. But I think if we could get, 20 to 25 Republicans to sign on to a letter asking for an opening of government, that I think that will carry a lot of weight.
What about the issue that's at the center of this? President Trump wants a wall along the border. He's been talking about it for a long time. And people have pointed out that in 2006, then-Senator Chuck Schumer and a number of other Democrats actually voted for the Secure Fence Act, which authorized a fence along 700 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border. Do you think that Democrats would be willing to support, as some of them have in the past, any additional fencing of any kind to get us out of this shutdown?
Well, we already have. I already have. In fact, I've already voted at least once to provide him with $1.3 billion in enhanced border security, which includes fencing. It includes more drones, more technology, and most importantly, more Border Patrol agent, and it includes more fencing. He already has that money, which, by the way, he has not yet spent. And so my question is, why are we holding the entire American people hostage, and especially federal workers, over a fight for something that he already has money to spend on that he hasn't spent?
I want to turn to the bombing in Syria that killed four Americans this week. You served in Iraq in 2004. You lost both legs and partial use of your right arm when your helicopter was attacked by insurgents. What was your personal reaction as a combat veteran when you heard about the attack in Syria?
Well, first and foremost, my heart went out to the family members of our four heroes who laid down their life protecting us and that allowing each one of us to go to bed tonight and for me to kiss my daughters, to good night each night, safely knowing that our young men and women are over there defending us. Bottom line, I was appalled. I really think that part of the brazenness of this attack results in the fact that ISIS is still very much active in Syria, despite what the president says. And his unilateral decision against his military commanders and his then Secretary of Defense to decide to draw pool U.S. troops without any type of a plan out of Syria contributed to ISIS, increased boldness.
How long do you think U.S. troops should stay in Syria?
Well, I think that we need to stay until we have a plan for how we defeat ISIS and suppress them. Right now, I don't know that there's a timeline. I think what needs to be done is we need to look at a conditions-based exit. I never supported putting U.S. troops there in the first place without an authorized use of military force vote in the Senate. And that's something that needs to be done. But now that they are there, we can't just pull out and abandon our allies who are in the region, especially the Kurds, who are going to be the target of attack, not just from the Syrian government, but also from Turkey as well. So whatever we do, we need to have an actual plan, whether it is milestone-based, timeline-based, or something, a combination thereof, so that we leave in a way that does not put our allies at greater risk, does not put U.S. troops at greater risk, and does not allow ISIS to regain a foothold in the region.
It does seem, though, like the U.S. experience since 9/11 is that once we have troops in a place, let's say Afghanistan, and then start to pull them out, or Iraq, and start to pull them out, the attacks start up again. Even if it looked like the terrorist group had been defeated, then they are able to regroup, and then it makes it very difficult for the U.S. to pull out.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that we do need to do is we do need to get into place a real system of local governance that would deny ISIS the ability to grow in the region. And that's happening in some parts of Syria where, with U.S. support, local government has come in that's denying ISIS the ability to regain its foothold. But, you know, they've just moved into other areas. And where the attack happened just 2 days ago is where ISIS has never been completely defeated. And we need to focus on putting some resources behind that region, whether with U.S. troops or with our allies.
Senator Duckworth, I finally want to ask you about something closer to home. Here in your home state of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, the Democrat, just took over as governor, and he gave an address when he did. One of the things he said is that he wants to legalize recreational marijuana in the state of Illinois. What do you think about that? And do you think that as a U.S. senator from Illinois, that marijuana should be legal recreationally at the federal level?
Well, I think that the federal government should certainly look to the leadership of states. I think this is definitely a states' rights issue. One of the things that we can do at the federal level, however, is we can look at our banking laws so that states and banks and the financial system is not penalized because of federal laws for decisions made at the state level. So that's something that I can certainly help to work on. Whether or not recreational marijuana should be legalized is something that the people of Illinois should be able to vote on. You know, I personally support legalization of medical marijuana. I've seen its effectiveness on everything from epilepsy to post-traumatic stress disorder and the like. I would like to really, you know, let the people of Illinois cast that vote. My job is to make sure that once that vote is cast, if it is legalized, that banks in Illinois, that the citizens of Illinois are not penalized by federal laws for something mm-hmm. that is now legal within their state.
But you don't have an opinion on whether it should be legal recreationally in the state of Illinois?
No, I want to wait and see what happens there. Right now, my focus is on making sure that we don't put citizens and businesses in Illinois in jeopardy with federal laws. I certainly support, as I said, medicinal use of marijuana. And I support, for example, allowing veterans to access medical marijuana even through federal facilities like the VA. As far as recreational use, if there is a way to do it so that we are not increasing the use of illegal narcotics, you know, as a gateway drug, then that is something that I'm certainly willing to consider. But I think that whatever we do, we need to move forward with caution and in a coordinated effort so that if the people of Illinois do support recreational marijuana, then we need to make sure that, again, that the federal laws are not going to put them into a gotcha situation.
That is Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois. Senator, thanks once again for joining us.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
This Sunday night, look up. There'll be a total lunar eclipse. It'll last until early Monday. You can see it from all across North America. It's being called a super blood wolf moon. Astronomer Dean Regas is at the Cincinnati Observatory, and that weird name, is that kind of the lunar eclipse equivalent of clickbait, Dean, or does it describe what the moon's actually going to be looking like?
That's catchy, isn't it? I don't know who came up with that. Not an astronomer, but yeah, the super blood wolf moon. Let's just call it what it is. It's a lunar eclipse, and that is awesome in itself when the moon goes into the shadow of the Earth. I can't wait for Sunday night.
So where'd the blood part come from? Is anything going to be red?
The moon does turn some eerie shades. Red is one of them, but you never know what kind of color that you're going to get during the totality. It could be grayish, ashy gray, orange, tangerine, or maybe even blood red. But boy, if blood moon gets people to look at it, we'll go with it.
Is a supermoon noticeably bigger than a regular full moon?
Well, so then we add that on top of it. The moon will be slightly closer to Earth than normal, and so it might look a little bit bigger. It's a little brighter than normal right when the eclipse starts. And the big thing is the timing on this. This is Sunday night, not Monday, so definitely want to check it out then.
What time, roughly?
Pretty much it's the same moon for everybody. That's what's so cool is if you're on the East Coast or West Coast, you're going to see it at about the exact same time, 10:33 p.m. For Eastern Standard Time. That's when the shadow of the Earth will start to appear on the moon. Totality happens from 11:41 p.m. to 12:43 a.m. Monday morning, and that's when it turns all the different colors.
But during that time, and that sounds like a fair amount of time to be watching totality, what's actually happening?
Yeah, so this isn't like the solar eclipse. It only lasts a few minutes. This one will last over an hour. And what's happening is, yeah, the sun, earth, and moon are perfectly lined up, and sunlight is coming through our atmosphere, bouncing off of our upper atmosphere and bending onto the moon, and that's what gives it that orangish color. It's like you're looking at all the sunrises and sunsets on Earth, but they're projected onto the moon.
And kind of in the bigger picture, remind us, fifth grade astronomy, what is going on?
Well, yeah, this is alignment of the heavens, and it's very rare to get all three of those bodies, the sun, earth, and moon, lined up like this. In the United States, we only see it about every 2 years or so, because the moon goes around the earth at such a distance and at such an angle that we can't get everything always lined up. So this is what's so special about this. And even better than that, it's visible to the naked eye, visible from coast to coast. This is something that everybody should look up and see.
The super blood wolf moon coming Sunday night. Dean Regas is an astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Keep looking up.
Well, here's a statistic that might surprise you. 7 out of 10 firefighters in this country are volunteers, and their ranks are thinning. Take a look at Pennsylvania, where according to a new report from the state, the number of volunteers is just 1/10 of what it was in the 70s. It's causing a crisis in some small communities. Sarah Kovash from member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports.
At a recent meeting of the Jefferson Hills Borough Council, one agenda item dominated the discussion.
I've completed numerous studies regarding fire service delivery, and I can tell you that almost they always end up being very emotional, and I do not envy council and the difficult decisions you have to make.
That's Nick Sahida. He's the fire chief in nearby Mount Lebanon, and he's at the council meeting to answer questions about an audit he finished for Jefferson Hills. The borough, about 10 miles south of Pittsburgh, is home to 11,000 people and has 3 independent fire departments. Each one has its own volunteer firefighters, chief, and protocol. But the borough has spent the last 3 years mulling consolidation of the firehouses. One department in particular has had trouble attracting new, younger firefighters and keeping them, Sahida says.
At a fire, you need people generally between the ages of 20 and 55 that go to training, that are physically capable, that respond fairly often, that are going to crawl down a hallway with a hose line, put out of your fire.
Over the years, volunteer fire departments like the one in Jefferson Hills have served as social clubs for the members who dedicate their time, as well as spots for community events like bingo, spaghetti dinners, and even weddings. But Sahida says a community firehouse does not make a fire department.
In most communities, we're not recruiting a lot of young people. And so what you get is 3 65-year-old men showing up on a fire truck, and you think you have a fire department.
At a recent party for Harmony, Pennsylvania volunteer firefighters, their kids and spouses are grabbing sodas from the ice chest and passing around plates of ham and fried chicken. Harmony, about 30 miles north of Pittsburgh, is an exception when it comes to recruiting young firefighters. The department has about 60 active members. That's partly due to a firehouse culture that's flexible, open to change, and caters to young members and families, says firefighter Matt Springer.
When younger members do come in, we look after them. We're making sure they're learning stuff. They're checking out the trucks, you know, just to keep their interest high so they keep coming back.
There are a lot of perks to being a firefighter in Harmony. Volunteers get a break on local taxes. They can earn points for each call they respond to and use them toward things like gift cards or firehouse swag. In Mount Lebanon, Sahida says he bought flat-screen TVs and PlayStations to make the firehouse a more fun place for volunteers to hang out. The more bodies you have in the firehouse, he says, the more people you can rely on for calls. Back in Jefferson Hills, the council vice president says the borough can't delay offering perks to young firefighters in order to have a functional fire service. Firefighter Nick Sahida reminds counselors that it's their responsibility.
You know, this, at the end of the day, this is about delivering fire protection to the resident of Jefferson Hills. Make no other mistake about it.
Behind me over there, there's a picture of a couple of boys on the wall.
This is Scott Gehring, the chief of Harmony Fire District. He gestures towards photos of 3 boys who are all in the process of becoming volunteer firefighters.
They overturned their vehicle into an icy pond and drowned and froze to death. And I was very close friends with all of them. We were caught with our pants down. If we were called, we couldn't have saved their lives.
Gehring says firefighters didn't make it to the scene of the wreck since they were already responding to a fire at the time. But he says it wouldn't have mattered since they didn't have the training needed to save the boys. It took that tragedy for Gehring's firehouse to start considering change. Sahida says other volunteer fire departments should follow suit. He says many towns are waiting on the state or county to come in and fix their problems, but that's not going to happen because providing fire services is the responsibility of each municipality. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Kovash in Pittsburgh.
A fifth grader there, Femi.
And what a beautiful voice.
Really. Teachers and their supporters are using social media to make their case for a lower class
perfect
size.
Perfect platform for a strike, for rallying people, for lifting their spirits. Vegan Jennifer, that's what this teacher calls herself online, says that any scabs who think they're going to use my classroom better be ready to bring their own paper, pencil, dry erase marker and eraser, pencil sharp, exactly. All of her school tools, she's locked away. She doesn't want the volunteer teachers to actually get any of her materials that she uses to teach her kids. And then the next post is very telling because it's a picture of all the school supplies that the school district is giving to the people who are coming in to break the strike. So that's a little insight into the tense and the tension that's happening between the school district and the school teachers, documenting everything online as they're having that battle. Janine Spohr is a teacher and she talks about how many days the strike has been going on, and it's wet and cold. It's been very rainy out in LA. And she says, but I'm going to rise to the occasion. I'm going out there on the picket line. Tweet one thing a teacher has done to change your life. UTLA strong is the hashtag. There were so many amazing stories about teachers. I had trouble getting through them all. I recommend you go to Janine Spohr's Twitter feed and look out for them. Here's one. My high school English teacher was challenging and kind and incredibly feisty. She pushed me to do more than I thought I could do. She edited my writing when I was the most vulnerable and broody. I'm a different person because of her. There are hundreds of these stories. Dan says, I can read this. Thanks to the teachers who taught me to read.
And Femi, on the other side, is the LA school district making its own case on social media?
As a school district Twitter page, you'd expect them to give out information about the strike, which they do. There's a hotline. There's information about negotiations. Very straightforward. But what they're also posting are kids in school, and they are tagging some of these pictures. Learning continues in schools. It all looks like a regular school day until you start reading the comments. And then Jay says, well, that student pictured on the computer is obviously playing a game. He actually just looked in a little bit closer. Veniza says that I'm really glad that these students are engaged in this task. These were teachers commenting here. But who graded the task and who's highlighting them?
Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You may have heard the news this week that Netflix is getting a little more expensive. The company announced it is raising prices by a dollar or two a month, depending on what plan you have. That means the cheapest plan will cost $9, up from $8. The most popular HD plan will cost $13, up from $11. And the premium plan will cost $16, up from $14. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what has the reaction been so far to the price increase?
So investors loved it. I think, as you mentioned, Jeremy, the rich get richer while grandma's DVD plan jumps $20 a year so that you can watch more Orange is the New Black, right? That's how I would describe mm-hmm. that. Because Netflix is a company used by and loved by digital natives in the millions, obviously people were talking about this on social media and people were saying, all of a sudden it's more expensive to Netflix and chill, right? People were, of course, talking about this. From what I've been seeing, there are a lot of complaints, but not the kind of like massive blowback you might expect from going bad viral. So I would describe the reaction, at least from what I've been seeing this week, as rueful resignation. Like a lot of people, including yours truly, really rely on Netflix for a lot of their programming. And what can we do? They've got us by the eyeballs.
Well, so that brings us to the bigger question, which is there are certain things over the last several years, new products that we rely on. And I would put, by the way, Amazon and its free shipping in that box as well.
Sure.
Or free Facebook, for example, or free Twitter. At what point do these companies say, okay, we've got them. Now let's raise the prices. Let's make every box that we ship out on Amazon be $5. Let's make people pay $10 a year for Facebook. Think about that. There's how many billion users? They could make so much money if they did something like that. And most people would probably stick with them.
You're painting a terrifying picture, Jeremy. We've all been horrified and disgusted by the fact they could do this and the possibility they might, right?
Right. So
people who look at pricing really carefully point out that $10 and $15 are these kind of psychological tipping points in price tags. Netflix's premium plan just crossed the line of $16. The lowest plan just jumped to $9. And, you know, for this premium content, these price tags are where people doing the bill paying, whether that's you or your friend or parents whose Netflix login you, quote, borrow, people are going to jump ship.
So what if consumers revolt over this?
Well, even though for tons of subscribers, Netflix is an essential part of their entertainment spending, the company is playing this tricky game, right? They are estimated to get $1 billion in revenue annually from just this price hike. But, you know, what will consumers put up with when it comes to pricing is still a tricky question to answer in the streaming world. I mean, we used to pay $80 for 500 channels of cable television, but now you've got Apple, Netflix, Time Warner, Disney, Hulu, HBO Go. That price tag is going up and up. Mm-hmm. And the people who are paying bills in the house are going to have to start making these decisions to cut out certain streaming services. I think consumers would revolt, probably not over this price hike, but if Netflix started adding advertising.
Hmm. We will see if that happens, or maybe when that happens. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here Now, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Protests are growing around the country as we are now on day 28 of the partial government shutdown. Many impacted federal workers missed their first paycheck last week, and that's when some began picketing on the streets. From Kentucky,
so we can get paid! So we can get paid!
To Texas. To California.
What do we want?
End the shutdown.
When do we want it?
Now.
Mr. McConnell.
Call the vote.
Mr. McConnell.
Call the vote.
Mitch McConnell called the vote. They're saying their last Friday, Debbie Mulliken joined a group of IRS workers in Covington, Kentucky to protest the shutdown. She's head of the local chapter there of the National Treasury Employees Union.
People could become homeless if it goes on for any real length of time. I have a young lady that's 30 years old, has three kids, and she's, you know, this is her sole source of income. She's, you know, not going to get a paycheck tomorrow or next month, and her landlord is not willing to forego the rent.
And on Tuesday, federal workers protested the shutdown outside NASA's Johnson Space Center. Lloyd Van Oostenrijk was among them.
I'm a trial attorney with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and I'm unable to do my job. And I shut down a private law firm about 4 months ago to rejoin the government and go back to work for EEOC and do civil rights work. And I can't do anything on my cases because the government shut down, which means not only can I not do anything, that means if you're an employee and you were sexually harassed on the job, you can't come to us and file your charge of sexual harassment because we're not there to take it.
Alice Purcell was at the Houston protest, too. She's worked for NASA for more than three decades.
This is getting harder and harder to find a way out for people. And this is, you know, there's no reason we haven't been paid. Continuing resolution, whatever. That's about it.
On Wednesday, Phil Miedema joined TSA and other federal workers at Sacramento International Airport protesting the government shutdown. He was all set to retire from his job as an internal consultant for the Coast Guard at the end of December, but he says he had to delay his plans because the people who could process his paperwork are furloughed.
So it's the uncertainty, I think, is the worst part. And the emotional uncertainty is really hard on everybody. I know it stressed my wife. My wife is stressed out. I'm stressed out. You know, and I think there's even a little mile of depression there, a little bit of depression because you're going like, well, what's going to happen here?
Some voices of federal workers who are protesting and going without pay amid the partial government shutdown. If you are a federal worker affected by the shutdown, we'd love to hear from you. Just go to our Here and Now Facebook page and let us know, and maybe we'll talk to you on the air. this is the week that the experts say we all give up on our New Year's fitness resolutions. That's right, 18 days into the year. So if that's you, what to do now? Jennifer Walters is a certified personal trainer based in Kansas City, Missouri. She's the co-founder of the online fitness platform Fit Bottomed Girls, and she joins us. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And do you really think that people have already given up at this point? It's only a few weeks into the year.
I know. It seems so sad, but I think it is pretty true. People get their hopes like so high and they get so excited on January 1, January 2, January 3, but you get a little bit later into the month and the gym becomes kind of empty.
Why is that? What is it that changes people's mindsets from the way they feel on January 1st and the way that they feel on, you know, January 20th or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the same thing that you feel on a Sunday night or a Monday where you're like, this week's going to be different. I'm going to be organized. I'm going to eat right. I'm going to have all these healthy plans. And then by like Friday, you're like, let's order pizza
right.
and stay at home. It's just a natural thing for humans to get really amped up and then maybe not have as much structure or bite off a little bit more than we can chew because change is difficult. The secret is really, instead of trying to do too much at once, setting smaller, easy habits, which doesn't seem maybe as exciting as much fun because it's not like go big or go home. It's more like start small and actually do what you want to do.
Right.
But it's actually what happens and what works.
Well, okay. So let's just talk to the people right now who may have made that resolution at the beginning of the year. I'm going to work out 2 times, 3 times a week, whatever it may be. And now they've given up. What can they do at this point to get back on track or to start a new track that they might actually stay on?
So there's two things I'd recommend here. The first is to find something that you enjoy that you really do like to do because it doesn't take any willpower or motivation to do the things that we like to do. Think about binge watching your favorite shows. Like you don't have to sit around and be like, oh gosh, when am I going to make time to do that? You do it because you want to do it. So pick something you want to do, whether that's dancing or walking or cycling, something that's fun for you. Then set a really small goal that you can hit, like 10 minutes a day, a couple times a week, every other day, and do that for about a month so that it feels like a habit and it feels weird if you don't do it.
Will you notice any changes, though, because of that? Like, let's say that you do 10 minutes a day of exercise. After a month, are you going to have lost a pound or two?
You know, for me, I think it's less about weight loss and it is more about how you feel. So instead of measuring your success by the number on the scale, look at, do I have more energy? Am I sleeping better? Am I less likely to get sick? Look at some of those other things on markers on how you actually feel. That's going to keep you more motivated because the scale can fluctuate so much based on what you eat, if you've gone to the bathroom, if you're bloated, like all kinds of reasons.
So make sure that you set a goal that's achievable.
Very achievable. Then once you have that habit set, then's the time to amp it up, add a little bit more time, try a different activity and begin to challenge yourself. But have the habit of exercise there before you go.
What is the key to maintaining that all throughout the year?
Oh, you just keep going. It is that habit. If you have that habit set, then you can just keep challenging yourself and really kind of play with it and have fun. I really recommend that people kind of look at their life and their fitness as kind of a choose your own adventure. We can be like, okay, now that I, you know, like to work out, what can me and this awesome body do? Maybe that's a race. Maybe that's doing a class with your friends. But it can become really fun once you have that basis of fitness there.
Now, I know that you say that people shouldn't measure their success by the weight on the scale, but obviously that is something that is important to a lot of people. What would you suggest to people who are not seeing results that they want as quickly as they expected?
Yeah, so I would sit down and make a list of all of the ways in which the changes that you've made have benefited you. You know, it can be anything from your self-talk to your confidence to your sleep to your energy. You know, you can look at different markers if you've had it tested, like your cholesterol, your blood pressure. There's many other ways that you can define and measure success and really think about, do I feel better than I did before? If you do, then holy cow, that's a huge amazing change you've made for yourself.
When people want to get in really good shape, what's the first thing you tell them to do?
Ooh, I would say you want a good mix of, you know, getting some cardio in, but also it's picking up heavy things, whether that is a barbell or a dumbbell or just doing some bodyweight exercise. That's the kind of stuff, building muscle, that really improves your body composition and changes what you look like on the outside mm-hmm. and does amazing things for your body and your health overall.
And watch what you eat.
Of course.
That's a big thing, is that if you eat the foods that make you feel good, but you don't eat that much of them, it can go just as far as eating a bunch of stuff that you don't like, but, you know, thinking that you're not having pizza and hamburgers.
Yeah, because your body will tell you a lot if you listen to it. You know, like, you kind of get those messages mm-hmm. from when you drink. If you drink too much, you're like, okay, that affected me. But a lot of food can kind of be the same way.
A lot of people doing dry January.
Yes. Yeah, that's a big thing
now. Do you support that?
Sure. I think it's always kind of interesting to see.
See what happens.
Yeah, see what happens, how it affects you.
I have to say that when we were talking in our staff meeting about the fact that we were going to be doing this segment with you, there were some people who said, oh, well, that's great when everybody gives up on their New Year's resolutions because then the gym's empty and I can go there and not have to wait for anything.
A lot of gym rats feel that way.
Exactly. I guess we have a lot of gym rats on the show. That is Jennifer Walters, CEO and co-founder of Fit Bottomed World, also a certified personal trainer in Kansas City, Missouri. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, what's your experience? Is your gym empty or are people still sticking with their resolutions and working out? Let us know, and let us know what works for you when it comes to fitness goals at hereandnow.org.
Yesterday, a Chicago judge issued a clean sweep acquittal of three police officers charged with covering up the 2014 murder of Laquan McDonald. That verdict came as a blow to police reform activists in the city, including William Calloway. He fought for the release of dash cam footage of the shooting back in 2015.
We know that this was a cover-up. Yeah. We know that these officers conspired to make sure Jason Van Dyke did not get charged with murder. They falsified those police reports. This blue coat of silence is real and it's thick.
Jason Van Dyke is the officer who shot 17-year-old McDonald 16 times. He was convicted of murder. His sentencing hearing is underway right now. Christy Lopez helped lead a Department of Justice investigation into the Chicago Police Department in 2017. We asked her if she thinks Van Dyke's murder conviction resolved the issues surrounding this case.
I think it was. I think it was important to the legitimacy of the court system and policing to see Jason Van Dyke be held accountable for murdering Laquan McDonald. But I don't think that we should take too much solace in that, because systemic police misconduct is never about the acts of individual officers. It is about the systems that tolerate and incentivize that conduct.
Well, the question is, was there police misconduct? And a jury has decided that Jason Van Dyke, the officer sentenced today, obviously was indeed guilty. Yesterday, the judge ruled that three of his colleagues who had been charged with a cover-up were not guilty. Let's listen to what the judge said yesterday. This is Dominica Stevenson's remark, saying basically you can't second-guess what the police did at the time because you weren't standing where they were. Let's hear this.
Only the officers involved in the incident know what their belief was at the time of the incident. We cannot now view the actions of the officers with the benefit of hindsight as to what they should have believed.
So the judge agreed with defense lawyers that even though the police reports did not match what was seen on the dash cam video, that doesn't mean police were trying to cover something up.
I mean, that statement from the judge, I think, is really misleading because, first of all, it was the Van Dyke jury that had the task of deciding what Van Dyke was thinking at the time. That was not at issue in this case.
That was the murder case, and we were talking about this case being the acquittal case of the
this is the conspiracy case. So what the judge is looking at in this case is after the fact, not at the moment, but in the weeks and months after this event, was this investigated appropriately, or did they try to cover it up? And that's not a matter of speculation about what was in anybody's minds. What these officers described in these reports was Laquan McDonald lunging at the officers. And that is just not what happened. You can see that in the video. You can see that in the testimony. You heard that in testimony from other officers that the judge discredited.
You've said that the results of this conspiracy trial could be even more important than the guilty verdict in Officer Van Dyke's murder trial. Why?
That's the case because these issues of police misconduct are about the systems that allow it to persist. And what we found in our investigation at the Department of Justice, we investigated the Chicago Police Department, and we found a code of silence. We found that the city does not take sufficient steps to prevent officers from deliberately concealing misconduct. And so this case was important because it was going after that system. That's how you're really going to get at this problem.
Remind us the investigation that you did and the finding that there is a code of silence that exists in the Chicago Police Department, which, by the way, the department itself says is not the case. What was the evidence that you found?
Well, we had many officers in the department tell us that there was a code of silence, and the mayor also said so. We found that the department not only tolerates but incentivizes a code of silence. They make it difficult for IA investigators to investigate whether officers concealed misconduct. They don't take steps to make sure that things like body cams and car cameras are working. So, you know, it's in our reports where we really talk about all the evidence indicating that there is, in fact, a broad code of silence within the Chicago Police Department.
Your investigation led to the drafting of a consent decree, which is a court-ordered plan for reforming the Chicago Police Department. I know, Christy, you have a larger concern about a memo that was released by the Attorney General Jeff Sessions on his last day in office that you say makes it difficult for the Justice Department to negotiate any effective police reform anywhere. Tell us about the memo and your concern.
Yeah, the memo is part and parcel of Jeff Sessions' hostility towards correcting police misconduct through proactive, preventative measures. I'm not worried about the Chicago consent decree because that is now being litigated by the state. I'm worried about the consent decrees in other cities where the Department of Justice is a party, because in those instances, those attorneys trying to enforce those agreements, I think their hands are going to be tied unless the federal judges in those cases really step up and make sure that those agreements are allowed to be fully implemented.
Christy Lopez helped lead the Department of Justice investigation into the Chicago Police Department after the 2014 police killing of Laquan McDonald. She's now a visiting professor at Georgetown Law School. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.